There came a point in my life where I had to realize that the way in which I was serving God was being disobedient to God, because the way I was serving God was simply a distraction and escape from what was a much greater responsibility that I had to my wife and God. I had a responsibility to love her and to become one with her, and it was just so much easier to escape to ministry than to do what I had promised I would do.
This is Christianity at Work, the radio ministry Mackenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon. The last time we were together, Dr. Jack Crabtree and marriage and family therapist Christine Barber were discussing the warning signs that indicate a marriage is heading in the wrong direction. The importance of the subject is obvious, and too often, we are blind to the signals that all is not well. Let's listen as Jack and Christine continue their discussion.
Last week we talked about ways that we break our marriage commitment or our marriage vow. We're going to continue with that in this program. Another way that we break our marriage commitment is by not making another person or our spouse the most special person in our life. We don't seek to understand them. We don't seek to respect them. We don't seek to delight in them. What are some ways that we might do that? What does it look like in our marriage?
Fundamentally, it seems to me that we distract ourselves from that responsibility and from that task. And I think we do that because, as we've discussed in past programs, it can be really difficult and it can be really hard and it can be really painful and grievous to enter into the task of seriously trying to understand and see life through the eyes of my marriage partner. If it gets too hard and too demanding and too painful for me, instead of facing into that task and keeping my vow and seeing it through and doing it anyway, oftentimes we run from the task and we create for ourselves various kinds of distractions that we busy ourselves with and occupy ourselves with instead of the task at hand to keep my vow to my partner.
So in other words, what you're saying is instead of committing myself to knowing and understanding my spouse and being committed to the relationship, I become committed to some other activity, and that's where I place my emphasis.
Yeah. And I suppose it's a way of, in a way, rationalizing or justifying my uninvolvement with my partner, that if I'm just too busy for it, it's not that I'm avoiding them, it's just that I'm doing this other thing. I imagine that's what our mind tells us. But that's exactly what it is a distraction that I have set up for myself so that I don't have to face into the painful task of becoming one with someone I don't understand, and in my sinfulness and my selfishness causes a tremendous amount of pain for me.
So I might do it with the motivation of staying away from a commitment in my marriage because I really don't get the other person. I don't understand them. You know, that's just a man. I'm just going to not try because it just becomes very difficult. But I think sometimes we don't want to become close just because emotional closeness is a very difficult thing for us. And it's a very painful thing sometimes. It's a very risky thing. Also, if I get to know my spouse, if I'm really becoming one with somebody else, oftentimes, don't you think, Jack, that it brings out who I am? In my marriage, more than any other arena, I'm having to look at my own failure in relationship, and I'm having to see that failure.
Yeah, yeah. And that's something we're really allergic to. I mean, that's just part of our natural sinful human rebellion against God, is that we don't want to face into the truth that I am inadequate, that I am unworthy, that I am immoral, that I am displeasing to God. That's not the image we want to have of ourselves. We want to have the image of ourselves as very much together and very much worthy. And we run from that with a vengeance.
Before God and before my spouse.
Yeah,
I don't want
absolutely.
To have to look at...
And before myself.
Before all of us.
Yeah.
I want to be successful before God, my spouse, myself. And if I'm not, then what I do is I take on other tasks where I can be more successful. Lots of times the task that we take on, especially in our culture, is work.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, work is a big one. If I can succeed at my profession, my career, I can have this sense of adequacy, this sense of successfulness, this sense of virtue, this sense of nobility that I am good at this thing and I am successful. And oftentimes it involves activities that don't confront me with my sinfulness in the same way. I'm crunching numbers or I'm making widgets, and they're easy to manipulate, and they don't talk back and they don't confront me with my selfishness particularly. My spouse does, and that I don't want that.
Yeah, that's very true. I can just get involved in producing or making something, and the thing can make me feel really good. If I can make a million widgets and make $1 million, then that's quite a pat on the back, and I feel like I'm doing pretty well.
Right.
And, Jack, I think sometimes even in jobs where we have relationships, that can happen also. Because if, for example, I'm even a pastor, if I'm doing church work, and I am having, you know, an hour counseling session, or I'm up front preaching, or I'm teaching a lesson, people don't really see the insides of me like my spouse does in the context of a marriage.
Yes.
I could look absolutely shining and good. I could portray myself in that way. I could tell stories that do that. I could look into your eyes as I'm counseling you and really care about you deeply. And what I'm getting then is a pat on the back.
Yes.
I'm being told, you are great.
And what we're doing, I mean, having experienced that, having been in that position, it takes an incredible amount of energy to be what you know you ought to be for an hour. But you can do it. I mean, you can just sort of rise to the occasion and in effect, act out the part of a caring, compassionate listener for an hour. But you know there's an end to it. You know, there's a time when you can come down and can crash and can revitalize your energy and be yourself. And it was just always so shocking to me to spend an hour, 2 hours counseling at the church, come home and crash and be so absolutely lacking in compassion and selfish and just a horrible human being in the context of my family. And yet, on the other hand, I understand it because that's who I really am. I mean, I'm fully a self-centered, evil, greedy, grasping kind of person, just like every other person on the planet. And when I'm not acting, when I'm not playing the part of a compassionate listener, the real me comes out. Hopefully I was committed to other principles, and in time I could always ultimately confess my sins to my wife and children and admit that I was being the jerk that I was being. I mean, I was committed to something higher than I behaved, but it did not come naturally. And I can get a lot of strokes by playing the part of a righteous person out there in relationship to other people in my profession.
Jack, let's take a short break and come right back to that.
Don't go away. We'll return to Jack and Christine in just a moment. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist with 20 years of experience. For her, the good news of the gospel is not some vague idea, nor is it just a set of rules to follow for worldly success. For her, the gospel is the message of salvation. Over the years, she has worked with people as they struggle with the weight of false teaching, misunderstandings, and bad advice. But she also sees that their real problems exist because they are sinners and in desperate need of God's mercy. Her goals are to help others become grounded in the truth of the gospel, to see themselves as they truly are, and to see that real change comes through the work of God. She's also a wife and mother who sees the truth of the gospel working itself out in her day-to-day life. Dr. Jack Crabtree is a philosopher by training, but more importantly, he is a man with a deeply passionate love for God's Word and a seeker of the truth it contains. He has spent years studying and interpreting the Bible. For him, the Bible is God's direct revelation about our world, about what it means to be human, and about God's goals for His creation. He has taught the Bible in churches in California and Oregon, as well as at the McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College. His goal has always been to get to the heart of the biblical message, even if it means re-evaluating many of the beliefs he previously took for granted. As a husband and father, he sees the truth of the gospel and God's wonderful mercy providing the only real foundation on which to live his life. Both Jack and Christine see a need to strip away the false beliefs that have crept up around the Bible and get back to the heart of the radical biblical message. And now, let's get back to today's discussion between Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barker.
We were saying before the break that it's easy on one hand to be involved in things, making widgets, being with people outside of our marriage, and getting a lot of kudos for that, getting a lot of pats on the back because we're successful in those endeavors. It's far more difficult to be involved in a marriage where day after day, after day after day, I'm with that person and they see who I am. It's easy for me to emotionally distance myself by being involved in other activities. We brought up the church as one of those, or not actually the church, but being a pastor, and that's a way that I actually can look good on the outside, and you were saying, but on the inside, I might look awful. You gave an example of yourself, and I'd like to go back to that. You were saying that on one hand, as a pastor, say doing counseling, you are incredibly compassionate, and then you find yourself at home and be a real jerk to your family. I know you were a pastor years ago, and you are also today. Are you saying that there is this schizophrenia that you experience now where you haven't really grown up? Or have you experienced a growing up where the compassion that you might show toward somebody in your ministry could sometimes look the same in your family? Have you seen an evolution of change in your own heart?
Well, I'd like to think that I've grown. The differences are less dramatic because I think over the course of time I really am more deeply committed to the values of God's kingdom, and that's able to translate into the way that I interact with my family to some degree. But I think it just seems inevitable that you will always see a kind of schizophrenia, and not just a pastor. I mean, I think everybody does. The classic example is the wife and husband arguing all the way to church, and then they park the car, get out of the parking lot, and they are all smiles to everyone around them. Sometimes that can be more dramatic than others. In some relationships, it's more dramatic than others. The other thing is that you can be in the midst of an argument, the doorbell rings, and someone comes, and all of a sudden the argument ends.
Or the telephone rings. Hello.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think there's any virtue with taking with taking all of my bad energy into my relationships with other people. I mean, I'm not saying the way to solve this hypocrisy or this dichotomy between who I really am and how I behave is to be bad toward everybody. I mean, there's a certain amount of social grace that is appropriate, I think, that we be to people gracious and kind and compassionate and put on that kind of face and present ourselves in such a way. There's nothing wrong with that, as long as we don't believe our own act, as long as we don't take to heart the way I'm acting with other people and pat myself on the back and say I'm a good person because of that. Where I really see my real moral worth is how I'm acting when I'm not acting out of social grace, when I'm just being my raw self. And more often than not, that's going to happen in the context of the relationships that are closest to me. My wife and my children. That's where my greatest hopes are. That's where my greatest fears are. That's where the greatest pressures on me are in relationships that mean the most to me. So my fears come out, my anxieties come out, my stresses come out. So when my kids disappoint me, if somebody else disappoints me, they disappoint me. If my kids disappoint me, I react. And I react because I've got all this fear of their failure or of their disobedience or of their rebellion or whatever. There's all this stress that is just going to manifest itself in that relationship. And what I need to recognize is that's the real me. I'm a weak person. I'm an inadequate person. I'm a scared person. I'm a fearful person. And ultimately, I'm a selfish and an evil and a sometimes pretty foolish person. And all of that is going to find its way out in my reactions to my wife and children.
Jack, as you're talking, I really appreciate your openness. It seems like we go into life looking at other people, their social selves, and thinking that I am so much less than or I'm other than. That person really is together, but I'm not at all. And what you're doing is really taking the veil off by being honest about who you are and saying, you know, I'd really, you didn't say this, but I'm sure you'd rather like to be able to say there isn't the schizophrenia in you at all. I'm not talking about that.
Yeah, I'd like to, but I can't. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But that's not true. But I think what does change, and let me see if you agree with this, is that when I first was in my relationship, when I was younger, I didn't see that I was really as wrong as I was. I really did think that when I got angry at my husband, that it was really his fault, that really if he would change, things would be better. And I think maturity comes in looking at my responses and saying, that doesn't have to do with Larry. It isn't his fault that I'm responding in this way. I need to look at me, and I need to, through my responses and through my failures, come to understand how God sees me, really, as a sinner that I am. And the response to that is a compassion toward Larry, is a understanding of my need for God, is a working harder to try and be a loving person.
Yeah, that's a profound point, I think. That, I think I would say the same thing of myself, that early I would look at my social self, as you called it, and think, that's the real me. Now, why is it that I deviate from my real self when I'm at home? It must be my wife's fault, or it must be my kids' fault. They're doing something to provoke me and tempt me beyond which I am able, and I can't be the real me. As we grow in wisdom, we begin to realize, oh no, I get it. The real me is the me at home. The social self is just the me I would like to be, or want other people to think that I am. And exactly that increased wisdom does bring a change, because it makes me more tender at home. It makes me more merciful. It makes me more understanding. I feel sorry for my wife and kids instead of blaming them.
We've got to be less tyrants. In that respect, we've got to be people who understand more and more our need for God's mercy.
Yeah.
And in recognizing that, be able to extend that to our family.
Yeah.
Because we really see who we are. Unfortunately, as we talked about in our last program, we don't do that. We try, very often we don't do that. We keep on trying to control, coerce, intimidate our spouse in some way, so that we don't ever have to experience this reality of who we are, as we're talking about today.
Right.
And I would encourage people to access that program to get some more information about this. I think that it really fits well into what we're saying today. So, Jack, what I'd like to do is go back to ways that we might continue to be unavailable to our spouse and, as such, break our marriage commitment. We mentioned the church a little bit, but let's go back to that some more.
Okay.
Lots of times the person that's in the ministry is really trying to serve God. And they are out of loyalty trying to serve God first. Yet there might be a spouse at home that's alone and just very much by themselves, perhaps raising the kids by themselves. Could you help that person out?
Well, we just need to be fully aware of this danger of turning, of being attracted to ministry. Not because it's what God has called me to do, but because it's a way that I can escape the hard work of becoming one with my spouse and connected with my spouse and learning to know and respect my spouse. It's a way of escaping that looks noble and virtuous and God-fearing and pious and looks unassailable, because if anyone attacks me for what I'm doing, then they're attacking the work of God. I mean, they're attacking a servant of God. I'm doing what everybody ought to be doing, so how can you criticize me for that? So one of the things that's attractive about it, I think, as an escape mechanism from marriage, is that it seems so unassailable. How's anybody going to criticize me?
Mm-hmm. And I might say, as the pastor or the missionary or the Christian worker, this is what God called me to do.
Right, right. And that's where we just have to be honest with ourselves. Is that really what's going on here? Am I doing this because God has called me to this, or am I doing this because it's too painful, it's too hard to make a marriage, and I need a way out? I don't think that God ever calls us to a ministry to such a degree and in such a way that I that I dishonor my spouse, my wife or husband. I just don't think God does that. I can't cite chapter and reference because it doesn't, the Bible doesn't address that specifically. But given everything that we know about what, who God is and what he's up to and what he requires of us and what he wants to accomplish in our lives, it seems to me that God would call us to something that fits within the boundaries of responsibilities, that moral responsibilities that I have. So if I have a moral obligation to do right by my wife, then my ministry is going to have to be limited by my obligation to do right by my wife. I don't think I have succeeded in that always in my ministry. I think I have been very unfair and very unfaithful to my wife at times by putting too much energy and too much stock in my ministry and forsaking her and my obligation to her. I think that's what Paul is getting at in the passage in 1 Corinthians where he talks about, he's encouraging people that in view of the times and in view of the stresses of this present age, if you can remain single in order to do the work of the ministry, of, to work for the kingdom of God, then that'd be great. And he says the reason that would be great is because a person who's married has all kinds of concerns that end up being a distraction from his ministry. Now, people misunderstand that passage. I don't think Paul is saying being single is better than being married, and really you ought to choose that.
That that's more spiritual.
Yeah, I don't think he's saying that's more spiritual, but he's just being really realistic here. He's saying there is a downside to marriage when it comes to doing the kind of thing that I as an apostle am doing, namely, there are moral obligations there that you've got to take seriously. And if you don't take them seriously, you're being morally remiss, and therefore it's going to limit your freedom in the ministry.
Well, he's saying that by implication. That
yeah, right. So it's a very high view of marriage, I think, is what he's speaking out of, a very high view of marriage as an obligation that we cannot shine on. You know, we can't just dismiss it and ignore it and say, well, I put God first. Well, putting God first when you're married is by doing right by your wife, keeping your commitment, being faithful to that relationship, honoring her, respecting her, getting to know her. And that takes time and energy, sorrow, grief, pain. It takes all of that, and I need to see through that. I mean, I need to live through that and go through that and not seek to escape it and avoid it.
So you're saying ministry isn't necessarily being a pastor or a missionary or some kind of Christian worker. Christian ministry really is doing what God's called me to do in the context of my first commitments, which is to the people that he's put in my life to love.
Exactly. If I can't meet my obligations to my wife and children, then how am I presuming to meet any obligations, demonstrate any wisdom, lead anyone into wisdom out there in the world? I'm not being wise if I've made this vow and I'm not willing to keep it. Where's my wisdom? And how am I going to lead other people to the wisdom if I can't even get to first base on my own?
Let's talk about some more ways that we might make ourselves unavailable to our spouse. You know, a way that might be pretty obvious is through hobbies that we get involved in. I was talking to somebody at a train show a few days ago, and they had just extensive tracks and all sorts of things, and they were talking about that and how involved they were in that and how much their wife hated it, and just kind of going into how much money it costs and the resources and the time. And I asked, well, then what's your involvement with your wife? You know, because he was very forthrightly saying how much his wife liked it and being very angry about that. And he said, well, I guess I just can't be involved with her.
Yeah, and I think that's not uncommon. Hobby, some kind of recreational activity that I become completely absorbed in or preoccupied with or obsessed with. Sports activities.
And the classic is the husband sitting at home watching that really important football game, and then that really important basketball game, and then that really important softball game, and I don't know what the next one would be.
Is there any other kind of game that's yeah. really important?
Right, and that's what ends up happening is it's one game after another, and we're kind of laughing here, but certainly that's not a laughing matter to a spouse who's sitting home, maybe not even sitting home, but wanting to be involved with their spouse, which is a legitimate desire and just can't get to him because the TV has a bigger hold on him.
So what do you say to those men out there who say, you know, give me a break, Christine. Why can't I just watch a football game or two every week? Are you saying I have to give that up?
Well, no, not necessarily. But I think we need to put all our commitments in line with our bigger commitment, and that's to love our wife, to delight in her, to make her special, to value her. If I can do that and have a hobby, that's great. If I cannot bring myself to do that, and not just by my own estimation, but in talking to her and to try and understand from her how she's perceiving our marriage, then I need to give it up, at least to some extent. Probably not fully, but maybe for some people fully, because, you know, remember that commercial? I don't know if it's still on TV, but it's you can't just eat one potato chip.
Oh, yeah. But you can't eat just one.
But you can't eat just one, that's right. I think that's very true for some people with their hobbies. Perhaps that's very true with sports. I just can't sit down and watch a show. I might then get hooked and watch it from, you know, 10 in the morning till 10 at night, or every single weekend, or, you know, so it's different for different people. I certainly don't want to suppose that I can put a rule on people and say I know each person. I think that would be wrong to do. But a man needs to make a decision wisely, thoughtfully.
Could sports be a way that a husband and wife could connect? Could
absolutely.
It be a part of the...
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
We might both love football. I know that my sister and her husband enjoy... She's down in San Francisco, and she likes... What's the football team down there?
49ers.
She died that I didn't know it. But she loves it, and that's a way that her husband and her both connect. They sit and watch the TV together. I don't get it. I don't like it. But she loves it, and they certainly do connect, and I think that's a nice way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my husband really likes sports, but I see him making some really good choices. He'll watch a show on the weekend. He'll also involve me in his life in different ways. It seems like he can have a lot of sports in his life and still be a very committed husband. I feel very much valued and very much delighted in him. I like the word cherished. I feel very cherished in my relationship with him. So there's no way in which he's giving that up. In fact, if you know Larry, you know he loves basketball.
Mm-hmm.
He's an avid basketball player. And yet he has approached it in such a way that I'm also very, very much a part of his life. Let's take a break here for a minute. We'll be right back.
Jack and Christine will be back in a moment. First, here's a question. What does it mean to take the Bible seriously? Does it mean that you carry your Bible with you everywhere you go? Well, maybe. Does it mean that you read it every day? Could be. Does it mean that you believe what it teaches is true? Certainly. But how do you know what the Bible really teaches? The staff of the McKenzie Study Center believes that discovering what the biblical authors meant when they wrote the Bible is central to taking the Bible seriously. At the heart of McKenzie is a desire to let the text speak for itself, to understand the Bible the way its authors intended. They believe the truth contained in the Bible offers a radical message for our world. They also believe that studying the Bible is a lost art. However, at McKenzie, studying the Bible is not just an intellectual exercise. It's about learning to see this world and to see ourselves the way God does. It's about coming to terms with our sin and God's wonderful mercy. It's about truly having hope in this fallen world. If you are interested in knowing more, we would like to send you our tape catalog or our free monthly newsletter, News and Views. At the end of the program, we'll tell you how you can get in touch with us. But right now, here again are Jack and Christine.
So what are some more distractions that we use to avoid really committing ourselves in our marriage?
Well, a highly artificial one are drugs, alcohol. Alcohol, I think, is a big, huge one that we just devote our time to trying to drown out the pain, mute the pain in our life with drugs and escape into the the pleasure or solace of a drug rather than face into the hard work and pain of the relationship. I think that's very classic and a very tragic mistake that people make.
There's no way that I can really connect with you if I'm not inside my own mind. If I'm taken over by another substance, the substance is what's going to be primary for me rather than being able to connect with you.
In your experience, does food perform that same function for some people?
Yeah, I think it really does. I think food can really become a comfort to people. It can become something that nurtures me. Very often people eat because there's something missing in their lives. They're needing to have something that feels warm inside, and food really does supply that physical warmth. So it becomes kind of a drug in itself, in the sense that it kind of mutes the discomfort or the anxiety that I feel inside. And my focus can be on how much I eat, how much I don't eat, when I should eat, when I should not eat, throwing up what I've eaten. It doesn't necessarily take...
Not necessarily overeating is the only... Is that what you're saying?
That's right. Right. That's right. Overeating does provide a lot of comfort, but it also can provide a lot of comfort by being distracted just by the whole issue of eating.
Of managing my eating.
Right. Yeah. So it can go either of those ways.
So just the whole point that food becomes a hobby, an activity, a business. It becomes the busy thing that I become preoccupied with to just take me away. I go there instead of facing into the reality of I've got a person here that I have an obligation to connect with. Mm-hmm. And however painful and sorrowful that might be, I've got to do it. It's mm-hmm. it's my commitment. It's my promise.
Mm-hmm. And I don't want to make this sound little. You know, for those of us who are not overweight, it looks like a really easy thing just to tell somebody, you know, you just need to stop eating and get involved in your marriage or get involved in being responsible with food. That's a really simple thing to say. It's very, very difficult for people who are overweight. To tell someone not to eat could be very similar to telling a heroin addict not to take heroin. It provides something that keeps them away from what they're afraid of, and it becomes a very, very big driving force in their life, particularly for people who have done it for a long time. I think in our culture today, one of the things that we use to distract ourselves a lot is the computer. People have become incredibly enmeshed in computer lives. I don't get that because I don't really like the computer. I use Quicken because
it's quick
and it's somewhat forgiving. You know, there's just so many people who are involved in ways that I don't even know or understand. I don't know the language. Maybe you can help us out.
Well, I could be really hooked on computers. I just think they're an intriguing machine, and I can remember the one encounter I had with writing a program for a computer. I was just completely all-absorbing. And I'd stay up late to work on the program, and I'd get up early to work on the program. And the problem solving, the learning curve that I was on, everything was just absolutely intriguing to me. So I can very much understand how people would get absorbed in it. And I can also understand how it could destroy a marriage, because it can be so all-consuming, it can't help but take you away from what has to be a greater loyalty and a greater responsibility and a greater commitment on my part, which is to do right by my wife. If you want an escape, boy, is it ready and willing to be that for you.
It's very intriguing, it sounds like, for you.
Oh, yeah.
It makes you feel smart. It helps with questions and exploration.
You know, I never used to understand... I don't understand people who like cars. I mean, I hate cars. They're nothing but a source of pain in my life. But, you know, it used to be the most technologically advanced thing in our culture were our automobiles. And, you know, you saw people putting new engines in their automobiles and souping up the engine and gussying up the outside of their cars, and it used to be a real preoccupation. I don't see that as much anymore. I think the real technological fascination for men has moved to computers. Not that the other doesn't exist, but I think more men go in that direction. And that, now I understand that, and that must have been exactly the same attraction to cars before. that cars had to mentor before.
Isn't there also a way to get onto programs where you can talk to other people, you can maybe have relationships with other people over the computer?
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea of a relationship in cyberspace is that it doesn't have to be real. It doesn't have to be at all true to reality. You can literally affect a persona and become someone other than you are. I mean, it's, in a way, it's the ultimate in escape. I don't like who I am. I'm going to become somebody else. I can't do that in real life, flesh and blood, but on the computer in cyberspace, I can do that. And again, I think that's a real attractive escape for people.
And I can really have a lot of kudos, a lot of a positive affirmation for who I am. We were talking about being a social person. It's not really who I am. It's who I project myself to be. So this is not a social self. It's a computer self that I project and people can like. And I can convince myself maybe that I am even that person.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, that's a scary thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very scary.
You know, Jack, I think another way that we can avoid our marriage commitment is by being people that are very secret. And I'm thinking of that in right now, I think, because I think the computer affords us a lot of secrecy. More and more in my counseling practice, I'm talking to people whose husbands or wives have been involved in clandestine affairs through the computer, and there's a lot of, I guess, pornography available, and they're involved with the pornography, they're involved with people, and there's just a lot of secrecy around that.
When you say an affair, do you mean just literally
an emotional affair?
Yeah,
right.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
or very much involved in pornography, and what they'll tell me is, well, my spouse. The person who's doing it will say, well, my spouse wasn't hurt by it as long as they didn't know about it. It's just that they found out about it, that it's a problem.
Hmm.
Can you speak to that? Are the things that we don't know about things that really don't hurt us?
In terms of the concrete impact of this, you might know better than I do, but I just in terms of the theory of marriage that seems to emerge from what the Bible teaches, I the answer would have to be, all those secrets hurt us because those secrets are a violation at the heart of what a marriage is supposed to be. If, in fact, marriage is making a commitment to become one with the other person, to share the same life experience with them, any time that I have a part of myself that I have closed off and not made available to the other person, I'm failing to make this one life experience that we are going through together and that we are confronting together. And that's the very thing that I think we're promising to do in marriage. We're promising to be one in that way. So any information that I withhold as a matter of principle is a violation of that. If I don't disclose our financial situation or I don't disclose the problems that I'm having with other people, difficulties I'm having with other people in my life, if I don't disclose to my wife what my fears are, what my hopes and aspirations are, out of some kind of self-protectiveness, then I'm violating that commitment. Now, I'm not saying that there may not be some things that I would not take initiative to divulge. I'm not prepared to say that. There may be times where I'm just going to not say something, but I'm not opposed in principle to divulging that information if it becomes important or if it becomes necessary or if my wife asks me point blank, is such and such the case or what's going on or tell me about something. It seems to me that part of my commitment is I've got to tell you what's going on. You want to know, you need to know, I'm going to tell you. For me to lie at that point or to conceal or to not tell the whole truth or to protect some information from her, I think is a fundamental violation of that vow that I made.
So you're saying that we really should, at least in principle, be willing to tell just about anything.
Anything, absolutely anything, yeah.
And that really is part of what defines our marriage commitment to each other, that we're open with information to each other.
Yeah. Maybe you can speak to what you've seen in terms of the consequences of not doing that?
Well, something that really came to mind for me when you were talking about perhaps my spouse coming to me and saying, is this going on? And you're saying we absolutely should not lie. But the reality is a lot of people do lie. Mm-hmm. And that's really, really crazy making. I think that I see this evidence of what's going on as your spouse, I think, for example, I might see pieces that give me an idea that maybe you're having an affair. And so for you to lie about it at that point is very, very crazy making. I really come to doubt my own perceptions. And I have to really change reality after a while. If you keep denying it, I keep thinking I'm seeing it. I changed my reality so that I can try to see reality the way that you do. I just think maybe something's wrong with me. And so I end up being a person who, over time, really lacks health because I've skewed my ability to see.
You've sort of entered into a mild form of insanity.
Yeah, kind of. And it's very, very difficult. Jack, though, I wanted to ask you a question. Mm-hmm. There are many people that have come into my office over the years that have said to me that they are having an affair or have had an affair, sometimes lasting for many years, but their husband or wife does not know. At that point, what do you tell the person? Should they tell their spouse? Should they not tell their spouse? It's a hard one, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a hard one. My gut reaction is, based on what the Bible has taught me to be my vision for a marriage, is that, of course, they ought to tell. I mean, that's my gut reaction. Now, I realize that when it really came down to the prospect of doing that, that would be really scary, because you are obviously jeopardizing the relationship itself. But, you know, my gut reaction is, but what relationship are we talking about? Aren't we talking about a relationship of real open-handedness and open-mindedness, and open-minded in the sense of divulging my life and the secrets of my life and the deep recesses of my life, and we can confront those realities together, solve the problems together, confront the problems together, and as partners get through whatever life throws at us. If life has thrown at me my moral failure and my unfaithfulness in my affair, then that's the problem that we need to confront. But if I'm serious about this marriage, we need to confront that together. So that's my gut reaction. Maybe someone could come up with some wisdom that would counteract that, but that's my gut reaction.
Well, Jack, I always struggle with it, but that's my gut reaction too. And the reason I struggle with it is because what I see is that maybe now the marriage could limp along and do okay, and there could be this kind of facade maybe growing into greater strength over years. But fundamentally, there's been a real huge break in the commitment, and if we're really committed to being one with each other, we've got to face into those things. The reason we don't want to is because the reality is my husband or wife could leave me.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is it could be such a rift in the trust that we supposedly have in each other that, you know, the marriage could be gone forever. But that's the place where I, in a very real sense, need to trust God. I need to be committed to doing what's the right thing. If God decides that he's going to strengthen my marriage through it, then that's good. If God decides that that's not the way it's going to happen, then that's not the way it's going to happen. For whatever outcome, I need to trust God, not try to be the designer of my own life. God's given me very strong directives. I'm supposed to figure out how to be wise, how to love, how to give. I'm supposed to be one with my spouse. I need to take that very seriously, even if it's going to create great suffering on my part.
And I think part of the wisdom that we need to learn is to face into the seriousness and the gravity and therefore the consequences of what we have chosen in the past. And, you know, I would think that one of the things that would motivate us is, you know, maybe even though I've engaged in a serious moral failure, maybe I can kind of escape the consequences. Maybe I can cover it up. And my strategy for doing that is I won't even let my wife know. That's another mistake, it seems to me. That's another part of the same foolishness out of which I made the decision to be unfaithful to start with. I've got to get over that foolishness. I've got to make a beginning to say no to being foolish and start being wise. And so I agree with you. I think it just seems to be the best way to do it is to be forthcoming, honestly, about my moral failure and my unfaithfulness, and then commit myself to solving the break in trust together with my wife and working at reestablishing that.
If they'll let me.
If they'll let me, yeah. And they may not.
Yeah, again, they may not.
Yeah.
It's a silly thing. Since we've made a mistake, if we don't talk about it, then we can make it all better. And that's just not the case. Right. I've made a mistake. I need to face into it. Even if facing into it means my husband or my wife has to work with the issue of not trusting me for the rest of our marriage.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me, and certainly I've seen this to be true, that lots of times, or not lots of times, but sometimes, a spouse doesn't want to tell about their affair because really they want to hold that in their back pocket. They might want to do it again. And if I tell you about it, then you're going to be on the alert. You might have trusted me before, seen that, thought that I was very much committed to you, but now if I tell you what's really going on, I'm really going to be a lot more suspect. And having an affair might be the very thing that takes me away from my anxieties. It might be what food is to you, or sports are to you, or a hobby is to you, an affair is to me. I'm using it as a way to escape what I'm afraid of, and I really feel like I might not be able to really make it if I can't be involved in extramarital affairs. So it kind of saves me from having to really commit myself to having to stop that.
Mm-hmm. I never thought about that, but that's a good point, that if I... If I admit to an affair now, that I'm making it much more difficult for me to continue that in the future. All the more reason, therefore, to divulge the information and to come clean on it.
All the more reason.
Yeah.
So, Jack, we're talking about ways that we avoid our marriage commitment through work, through hobbies, through substances, through computer, and on and on. I'm sure we could really add to that list. But what if I'm the spouse and I say, but you know, my husband really isn't interested in me. So why not be involved in my kids to the extent that I'm not really involved with my marriage partner at all? Why not be involved in this hobby that I really enjoy? Because my spouse really is not committed to me. So what are you telling me, that I stop this involvement that I really enjoy and am interested in and go into a space of nothingness?
No, I think what we're talking about is, we have to remember that ultimately my marriage is not about my spouse. My marriage is about me in relationship to my God and the promises that I've made. What am I going to do with those promises? You know, just like you were answering with respect to the husband in sports, yeah, there's all kinds of activities that I can have outside the home and outside the marriage that can be very rewarding to me. But am I keeping my promise? Am I keeping my vow? Am I doing right by my husband in the way that I promised, whether I knew that I was promising it or not? It's the nature of marriage that I was getting into, that it involved this promise. And if I want to take that seriously, as I should before God, am I doing that? Am I keeping my promise and doing right by my husband? It's about integrity. It's about righteousness. It's about goodness. It's about being faithful. It's about being loyal in all those ways that godliness demands. Am I or am I not interested in being a godly woman? That's the issue.
We're at the end of the show, and as you're answering my question, I'm liking your answer, and I'm wanting more. And I think that a lot of people out there are wanting more, so we really need to address this again. And the question that we need to address again is, if I do decide to be committed to my relationship and my partner is in no way willing to be committed to that, or in very limited amounts, then where does that leave me? Where do I go? What do I do? What's that look like? And certainly that's a question that many people in a very practical way are looking straight in the eye at today as they listen.
We'll return to Jack and Christine in a moment as they conclude their discussion on breaking the marriage vows. Some people ask the question, what is McKenzie Study Center? Well, McKenzie has been described as a Christian think tank, as a group of mavericks answerable only to themselves, as a breath of fresh air in a room of stodgy religiosity. It's been described as a forum from which the tough issues of life and theology are reasonably addressed. Let me try to describe McKenzie in this way. McKenzie Study Center is a 13,000 square foot former fraternity house located within a block and a half of the University of Oregon. McKenzie is 5 full-time staff researchers and teachers, plus several part-time instructors. McKenzie is 20 to 25 people living at the study center while working in the community, studying at the university, or with McKenzie staff. Mackenzie Study Center is the papers, seminars, and conferences that challenge the way we often do Christianity. And Mackenzie is this weekly radio program, Christianity at Work. And though their conclusions regarding biblical and social issues may differ from yours and mine, you need never question the Mackenzie staff's willingness to bow to the authority of the Scriptures. Would you like to know more? Call the Study Center. Ask to be placed on a mailing list that will assure you receive the monthly News and Views. It's free and it's informative. Call area code 541-485-4801. That's area code 541-485-4801. Let's get back to Christianity at Work.
What we've been talking about today takes us back to what I think is a definition of marriage in Genesis. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. And we've been talking about that aspect of marriage that involves the two becoming one flesh. There seem to be two aspects of that. One is that we are two very different people who are going to become one flesh, and as different people, we need to acknowledge that my marriage partner is another person before God, made in the image of God, worthy of honor and respect and trust and dignity that I need to honor and respect. That's what we talked about in the last program. In the program today, we've been talking about the commitment to become one with that other person. The problem that we've seen in past conversations is that can be a very, very difficult and a very painful and very hard task. We don't naturally understand the other person because they're so different than I am. They're a different individual. They are a male or a female and a different sex than I am. And because of their different sex, they experience and look at and perceive the world differently than I do. And it really becomes hard to come out of my self-centered, selfish self in order to identify and understand and appreciate that other person. And it's difficult because in the process of doing that, I have to come to terms with my own evil, how inadequate I am, how terrible I can be, how cruel I can be. And I don't like to see myself that way. And all of those things make marriage so difficult. And so it's very easy for us to want to say to that task, it's too hard, it's too painful, I want out. And we look for any number of distractions out there in the world to give ourselves to them so that we don't have to keep my vow of becoming one with that person so different than I am. We go to the computer, we go to work, we go to some sports or recreation or leisure or hobby or drugs or whatever, but we find anything out there that's attractive to us that allows me a way to escape. But the thing that we need to realize when we do that is that we are breaking our vow. We made a commitment to that person. We made a commitment to God. I will become one with that person. I will learn to know, understand them, to know them, to appreciate them, respect them. If we don't follow through on that task, we are not being faithful to our God.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon. If you would like a free copy of this program or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at 541-485-4801. Or you can write us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And if you enjoy surfing the net, look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. And I'll repeat the phone number and address in a few moments. The Mackenzie staff is dedicated to pursuing wisdom, growing in love, understanding God's Word. They invite you to join them through listening to this program, attending their classes and seminars, or by reading their articles, papers, or books. They trust their research and teaching will be used by God to minister to others. The Mackenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street. That's 1883 University, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request the free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is area code 541-485-4801. 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.